examples. Okay, so this is the main part of my talk. This is the work that I'm doing with collaborators. And those of you who have heard me give a talk before, this has been the philosophy for quite some time, to use a very large magnetic field to suppress the superconductivity and see what's happening in the electron system at low temperatures. And in this paper, some time ago, we found that when you suppress the superconducting dome, which is given by this dotted line here, so this is TC versus doping, the number of holes per copper, we saw this insulating behavior that extended throughout the underdope regime. And the insulating behavior was characterized by a logarithmic divergence of the resistivity. And some years later, this is a pretty slow business, so it's good that I'm in management, so I have something to do while we're working on developing the techniques. So it took quite some time to be able to get the sensitivity for these lower resistivity samples to be measured in these pulse magnets. And we once again found a log T regime, and I'll show you that raw data, but it's a much smaller in extent in phase space, if you will. And it doesn't reach all the way out to optimum doping. And the data, you can see the huge advances in plotting data in the interim to 2003, where this is now Hall density, so it's 1 over the Hall coefficient, which we're taking liberties maybe to interpret as density, but I'll show you why we do that. And we see that at high temperatures, as a function of doping, there's very smooth behavior. And then once you cool down to temperatures where the system would be going superconducting if the field weren't on, you see this mountain occurring in the Hall density. So this peak, if you project this data down on this plane, this peak occurs right around 0.15, which is near optimum doping. This is in BISCO, yes. Same system as over here. So the cast of characters. Fyodor Belekarev is the first author on the BISCO paper with the Hall data, and he spent quite a few years working with John Betts and Albert Migliori getting the signal to noise to the point where we can make these measurements. So we're measuring micro-ohm centimeters in resistivity in an environment that's pretty harsh. We put kilovolts across the magnet when we pulse the magnet. Al Pastner helped with the early explosions. And then over here, the samples, we'd be nowhere without the samples. And in particular, there's been a long collaboration with Yoichi Endo's group to create these samples. So this is a generalized phase diagram of just about anything. The general theme here is that at quantum critical, or at quantum phase transitions, so in the zero temperature limit, as you vary something, magnetic field, pressure, or doping, if there's a phase transition between two phases, and you ask nature what does it want to be, phase A or phase B, nature often answers with phase C. That's a lot like a five-year-old in that regard. And this phase ends up being stabilized somewhere near the quantum critical point. And frequently, at higher temperatures around that quantum critical point, you get some sort of strange behavior. So it's, of course, no surprise to this group that this is the picture, at least phenomenological picture, that I have of high TC. And I'll mention a few other systems where very similar phase diagrams are showing up in completely different systems. So this is a very good review article that mentions quite a few of the early observations, many of them coming out of the Cambridge group. This is an anti-ferromagnet, and you tune TNAL with pressure. And when pressure gets around 26, 27 kilobars, you expect to just go over to a paramagnetic metal. But instead, right here, there's a superconducting dome, a superconducting phase. This is the same data amplified. So TC at its maximum is about 0.35 Kelvin or so. This is uranium-ruthenium-2-silicon-2, which if you were to draw the same phase diagram, first of all, you notice that magnetic field is a thermodynamic parameter being used to tune to the quantum phase transition. If you go all the way out here to zero Tesla, where most of us live, this phase, which is still unexplained, comes up to 17 Kelvin. It's called the hidden order phase. There's a very large specific heat anomaly, but only a few hundredths of a Bohr magneton in magnetic moment. And so it's not known what order gives rise to this phase, but it was noticed recently that magnetic fields suppress the phase, and at about 36 Tesla it goes away, and lo and behold, there's another phase which emerges at higher fields still, which is nicely known as the reentrant hidden order phase. So if we get enough letters, then we can feign knowledge, I guess. The thing that was interesting, and there's a real sequence of papers here, the thing that was interesting is that it was then subsequently noticed that there's a metamagnetic phase transition, which is coming down almost vertically on this graph between itinerant F electrons and localized F electrons, which seems to be stabilizing this phase. And when you go to lower temperatures, you find that this phase boundary coming down ends up having another phase. So it starts looking almost like a family tree, if you will, where subsequent daughter states, if you will, are stabilized by the quantum phase transition of the parent state. And so all of these have the same sort of phenomenology of the importance of quantum phase transitions in stabilizing some other phase. So this is a generalized phase diagram, I think, that first appeared in this science paper by Phil Anderson, and he, you know, identified all of the physics that's going on in each of these places. This is the messy insulating phase in the strange 2D metal. This in particular is where the resistivity is linear in temperature, which is true from 10 Kelvin all the way up to 1200 Kelvin, dead linear in temperature, and still remains unexplained. And it's also the case that this linear behavior is well correlated with when the superconductivity is most robust. So there's a, in this same paper, I think, or maybe a more recent one, there's a comparison of sort of BCS behavior and the coupe rates, and essentially they're different in all counts, and I know this audience understands all the phenomenology that are different between the BCS superconductor we know and love and this confusion that's going on in the coupe rates. We're actually still quite limited in the measurements we can make in 60 Tesla fields. We only have 10 milliseconds of which to make the measurements. And so our early work was just on resistivity. The work I'm reporting today is Hall effect. What we find is that even though it's temperature dependent at high temperatures, which no one understands, it ends up being temperature independent below about 15 Kelvin. And so we interpret the Hall effect as giving us information on the Hall number. We don't yet, nobody can do neutron scattering on these timescales. We're working on doing sigma of omega with various techniques, and we're working on both thermoconductivity and specific heat, making specific heat measurements in sub 10 milliseconds, sub millisecond timescales. But each of those techniques takes about 4 or 5 years to develop. So that's pretty much as the level at which I understand our power supply. You charge a large capacitor bank, of course it would fill about half of this room, maybe all of this room. You charge it to 12,000 volts, and you throw a switch, and you get a big magnetic field. You would ordinarily think that just put more turns into your magnet, and you'll get a higher magnetic field. There's no, in principle, no upper limit to the magnetic field you can generate. But the problem is that strong electromagnets generate big forces which are radially outward as long as you keep your left hand in your pocket. The pressure that's generated by these magnetic fields, given this sort of international standard, if you go to the ocean floor, which is on average 12,000 feet, you're getting 6,000 pounds per square inch. I apologize for the archaic units, but that's how we buy our steel. And the pressure we've got inside our pulse magnets is 200,000 pounds per square inch, 1.4 gigapascals. This is about a factor of two stronger than structural steels. And so you can't use most materials in these magnets, either as conductor or as a reinforcing material. And so we have been working in nanoscience since before we knew there was any money in it. And essentially what we're doing is making a nanoscale composite. So you make, you put 20% niobium in 80% copper. The niobium makes these little droplets. You then cold work this material by drawing it out until the niobium filaments are on a very fine length scale. This is now 1 micron here, is the width of the ribbons of niobium, and the thickness is a factor of 10 to 100 smaller than that. And this, you could sort of think of it as rebar, steel rebar in cement, but in fact it's much more profound than that, because with steel and cement you basically just get a rule of mixtures in order to get the mechanical properties of the composite. But here this fine length scale, in particular the ribbon shape, gives you a very effective way to pin dislocation motion. And so in fibers that are roughly the size of a human hair, my colleagues have been able to reach within about 20% of the ultimate tensile strength of the material, which is when you're failing every chemical bond simultaneously. So effectively, there's no dislocation motion if you go as far as you can by pushing this nanotechnology. The problem is that these wires end up being a little too brittle for us, a little too resistive, and so we're always balancing one property against another. And this is relevant. This is at 9:15 a.m. This is 5-ton magnet. And this is a second later. And I like to point out, this is the Magnet Lab logo. There's nobody here from the NSF, is there? This is the NSF logo, and you see which one was smart enough to get the hell out of the way. We found the NSF about 50 meters away, hiding under an equipment rack. So this is an example. Essentially, pulsed magnetic fields are applied metal fatigue. And trying to predict exactly when the paperclip is going to break is not always easy. And so we ended up doing about 6 months of analyzing the debris. This is the bore tube. This is only about 0.1. Well, how thick is this? It's a very thin-walled epoxy bore tube. And you can see that the 5 tons all went radially outward. The sample was still in there, but the leads were detached. But you have to try, because you never know how, until you spread your wings, you have no idea how far you can walk. And so we're actually paid to work on this cutting edge, or bleeding edge on occasion, in order to do experiments that can't be done in lower fields. And one of the features of the high TC cuprates is the TC is so high that it takes a very large magnetic field to kill the superconductivity. In fact, the reason we're studying LSCO and single-layer BISCO is that the higher TC compounds have too robust a superconducting phase, and it takes more than 100 tesla to kill the superconductivity. And we're working on 100 tesla magnets now, in fact. So if you take a look at LSCO, you've got the copper-oxygen planes. And as a function of doping with strontium, so this is underdoped with 0.08 strontium down towards optimum doping and then overdoping, in a zero magnetic field, you get these sorts of transitions. The resistance is dropping and then it goes superconducting. But if you suppress superconductivity, you get this nice insulating behavior. Around 1/8, there's a huge magnetoresistance, and we really don't understand what's going on around 1/8. But on either side of it, you get insulating behavior that seems to be diverging relatively rapidly. And then near optimum doping, it seems to come in and stay at a finite conductivity in the zero temperature limit. And so it looks like there's a metal insulator crossover, which in this case is occurring right around 0.15, 0.17, right near optimum doping. And then the more recent experiments in single-layer BISCO in plane transport show behavior that's similar in some ways. You've got the same behavior where the underdoped sample comes down and goes superconducting. If you suppress the superconductivity, you get a very strong divergence. And then as you approach optimum doping, you get the linear T behavior, at least as linear as this pointer. And then it stays metallic in the low temperature limit. So again, you seem to have a metal insulator crossover under the superconducting dome. So the underdoped side, when it's not superconducting, wants to be an insulator. And then the other thing that we noticed is whether you're measuring in-plane transport or C-axis transport, you get a logarithmic dependence of the resistance on temperature. And it's very difficult to prove a logarithmic divergence experimentally, particularly in the absence of guidance from theory. But this is about as good as I've seen, with a factor of almost 4 in dynamic range on the vertical axis. And this is base 10, so we've actually gotten up to a factor of 30 or so in the temperature. And in BISCO, the story is quite similar. So this is the BISCO data, resistance versus log T. And in the underdope regime where this thing is diverging, here now from 30 Kelvin to 0.3 Kelvin, we've got a log T divergence. We cannot go below 0.3 Kelvin because, again, we're in a pulsed magnet, so you can't, nobody's yet gotten a dilution refrigerator to work in a pulsed magnet, at least, and still produce science. If you plot this same data on a log-log plot, there does seem to be a pronounced curvature to the data. So it does seem to be sub-power law divergence. And if you compare the two, there's actually some striking similarities. So I've scaled these vertical axes so that they're no longer the same in units of milliohm centimeter, but they're the same in units, natural units, if you will, KFL. So it's resistance versus copper oxygen plane as determined by resistance divided by the C-axis unit cell parameter, and then you've got fundamental constants in KFL. So if this is a 2D Fermi liquid, we can at least estimate what is the product of the Fermi wave vector and the mean free path. And the crossover is somewhere between KFL equal 10 and 15 between the metallic behavior and the resistive behavior. Sorry, say again? The coefficient.
Resistance per layer.
Right.
Is h over d squared log times the number.
Yes.
What is that number?
It's been a while since I've done that. It's similar to what you expect in weak localization, which is about 0.1, 0.2. Yeah. And if you overlay these data, well, first of all, the similarities. The insulating behavior occurs under the superconducting dome. It occurs at the same normalized resistivity, around 10 or 15 or so. You have a log T divergence. And if you overlay the LSCO data with here, you see that at least you're in the same regime. The slope difference, I don't know how to interpret that. We do have some evidence from two different samples that this slope is linked to how much disorder you have, that you get a larger coefficient for more disorder and a smaller coefficient for less disorder. So it seems that this log T is related more to the mean free path, the cleanliness of the system, and at least exists in the underdope regime, but isn't necessarily tied to specific carrier concentrations. It seems to be some sort of localizing mechanism to which the underdope state is prone if there's enough disorder. Well, taking that phenomenology and looking at a quantum critical point approach to high TC cuprates, there's this paper by Subir, and it goes through a picture of high TC superconductivity, which suggests that temperature, as evidenced by the linear resistance near optimum doping, is your only energy scale in controlling the physics, and that the critical fluctuations might mediate the interactions between quasiparticles that give rise to superconductivity, and the non-Fermi liquid behavior that's observed near optimum doping. So the generic phase diagram, if you will, in theory space is some sort of coupling constant that gets varied, and on one side you have a magnetic state with long-range order, a quantum disordered state on the other side, and you would only get this quantum critical behavior right at one particular value of this coupling constant, or if this is an accurate analog in experimental space, one particular value of carrier concentration would exhibit this quantum critical behavior. And then the quantum critical behavior would go up to some maximum temperature, which a priori is not known, but at least experimentally, if the linear T resistivity is attributed to quantum critical behavior, it can reach up into hundreds of kelvins. So using that picture, the thought is that maybe near optimum doping, at least in LSCO, where there's a relatively sharp insulated metal crossover, perhaps there's a quantum critical point. If so, that's where linear T resistivity should be robust down to the lowest temperatures we can achieve. And so far the measurements suggest, well, the measurements have only been able to be done above about 10 Kelvin or so. And so what we've done is searched quite a few samples to see if we can find one particular sample where we get linear resistivity to low temperatures. So just to remind you, we've got insulating behavior, we've got some sort of metallic behavior. This one actually looked, although if you blow it up, our signal to noise wasn't good enough in the early days, but looked like it actually might be retaining a finite slope down to low temperatures. So in the early days where 100 milliohm centimeter, 0.1, that's right. 100 microohm centimeter was about the signal to noise that we had. We've now improved the signal to noise dramatically, and we've gone back and looked at some of these samples. And here in particular, you see that for X of 0.22, this is pending precise calibration because the final determination of the X value is destructive to the sample. So you want to make sure you've made all the measurements you can. But here on this sample, we've suppressed superconductivity up to 42 Tesla and at least down to about 1.5, 1.2 Kelvin. This looks dead linear with temperature. If you go to a slightly lower doping, 0.20, you see this sort of saturating out to some metallic behavior. And we're trying to get magnet time. Even I have trouble getting magnet time on the DC magnet. We're trying to look then at higher X values to see if we get the saturating behavior at low temperatures again, if there's just a single carrier concentration at which the resistivity is linear in temperature down to the lowest temperatures we can achieve.
Now you're moving away from the 0.16 point.
I mean, right.
What was the precise way you identified 0.16?
So 0.16 was identified as the fact that you've between 0.15 and 0.17, you've got this one coming down and looking constant within, say, a 10% noise factor, and this one coming down and almost doubling its resistance in the last few kelvins. So this looks insulating to us, that looks metallic to us. So that's the one phenomenon, which is at 0.16, plus or minus 0.01, I would say. And then this is, I'm certain that this is not 0.16. This may be 0.20, it may be 0.24, but it's that sort of error bar. And so this linear behavior seems to be occurring at slightly overdoped. And this is much closer to the type of carrier concentration that gets discussed by Lorem and Talon from evidence on specific heat in large polycrystalline samples. And I don't actually know what to make of sort of a multiplicity of phenomena that are going on down here, but at least in the quantum critical picture, this seems to be the more compelling evidence for where the crossover, where the quantum critical point exists. So in looking for other measurements, this is kind of reversing the history. We wanted to look for other measurements that we could make, and so we worked towards Hall effect. And in the meantime, in two papers, one in 02 and one that just came out last week, there's work by Epley and Rosenbaum on chromium doped with a little bit of vanadium. So chromium is an antiferromagnet, but it's very close to a quantum critical point. If you get about 3.5% of vanadium in it, you destroy the antiferromagnetism. So here's TNAL as a function of doping with vanadium. Magnetic moment per chromium atom, and then they measured the Hall effect. There's not a lot of data on here in order to claim that it's a step function, but in the paper that's come out last week, they take that same region, they fix the vanadium concentration, and then they use pressure to tune in a very nice and reproducible way back and forth through this quantum critical point. And so they've been able to explode, if you will, this very thin pink region into a very wide region, and they're able to measure critical exponents in this chromium doped vanadium system using both resistivity and Hall coefficient. This is 1 over Hall coefficient, so this would be corresponding to Hall number. One of the interesting things about this result is that you don't have to have an incredibly complicated quaternary compound in order to get quantum critical behavior. It's a relatively simple metal, BCC metal, but for me at least, it's an indication that in a system where you have the luxury of making much more accurate measurements, you can actually probe the quantum phase transition using Hall effect. And so to come back to the cuprates, this is what we've done. Some time ago, Yoichi and his group made quite a few samples of single-layer BISCO. These are the 6 that I'll show data on across the superconducting dome. And as a function of temperature, you can see there's this strange temperature dependence, and they seem to be dropping at around 100 Kelvin or so. This is quite consistent with the data from Ong's group, where they were reporting that in a high temperature region, you can think about the cotangent of the Hall angle going as T squared. The resistance goes roughly as T, the Hall coefficient goes roughly as 1 over T, that's this regime, and emphasis on the word roughly at least, goes as 1 over t, and there's discussion about the two scattering mechanism in the cuprates. That's not the regime we're interested in. As with the transport, our question, the question we want to answer is what happens at low temperatures? Because you can see all of these things are starting to dive down. In fact, these two end up crossing, these two data sets end up crossing at about 50 Kelvin. And only with a pulsed magnet could you figure out what's going on at low temperatures. So here's what the data look like. These samples now have the lower resistivities than in LSCO. So here's microohm centimeters, 100 microohm centimeters. And in the pulsed magnet, we're getting much cleaner data with this new technique with our own electronics. The Hall resistance is now just a few microohm centimeters. So the noise figure is tenths of a microohm centimeter. And you see at 50 Kelvin above TC versus magnetic field, the data are linear in magnetic field. And as you go below TC, you see evidence of superconductivity. And then finally, at our lowest temperature, at least in this graph of 1.3 Kelvin, you see that there's no Hall coefficient until you start destroying superconductivity. And then once you've destroyed superconductivity, you've recovered this linear and B behavior. So we interpret this slope as the Hall constant, and 1 over this slope in the low temperature limit we'll interpret in the conventional way as carrier concentration. Sorry? Yeah, so this is rho xx here. And so this sample would look metallic if you just did a rho versus T. Resistance is dropping and then saturating below about 10 Kelvin or so. So these are the data that I showed earlier. And these are the data in a pulsed field. So we're plotting rho h in each case. We've normalized per unit cell. Versus temperature, the data set sort of comes screaming along. And the first thing to check is how consistent are our pulse field measurements with the DC measurements, and the consistency is actually quite good. So this is a sample that matches very well the data taken in a DC magnet at higher temperatures, and then there's this divergence which suggests a freeze out of carriers in the extreme underdoped regime. This is a sample that nominally should agree with this one, but it looks to me like the carrier concentration is just slightly shifted. These are not identical samples. They're from the same batch, and so this is consistent with the slight difference in doping. After all, this is 0.73, and that's 0.76. If you look at the dark blue, it picks up this line as it should. The red one picks up that one. The sky blue picks up this one, and you reproduce this crossing at about 50 Kelvin. So we were quite relieved that the pulsed field data end up reproducing very nicely the DC data taken at higher temperatures. Sure. Ah, okay, yes, sorry. I've been working with this too long. This is the concentration of lanthanum, and as you add more lanthanum, you have fewer carriers. So the X is lanthanum, and of course here I don't have X anywhere. So if you have no lanthanum, then it's bisco, single layer bisco, it's on the overdoped side, it's sitting about here in the phase diagram. You can't get more overdoped. It ends up being rather linear, and I think I have a view graph in this talk that shows how we do that. No, I don't in this talk, but I can get it for you. It ends up being quite linear, but it takes a lot of lanthanum in order to change P. So the coefficient is not 1. So this is with no lanthanum, and then if you get up to 0.84 lanthanum, you've gone down here and you've killed the superconductivity. So 0.84 in lanthanum is only changing your carrier concentration by 0.08.
So the Hall number is the measure of the number of holes, the number of electrons?
It's definitely holes, yes. So the first thing I'd like to say is not concentrate on the low temperature behavior, so I've set all that to 0. Just look at this smooth background. And some time ago, Shastri, Sriram, and Singh looked at the TJ model, and using different parameters, they plotted the Hall coefficient versus doping. Of course, if you just have a cosine wave, then you're going to fill the bottom of that, and you'll have hole-like behavior. Well, I'm used to semiconductors. You'll have one sign, and then once you've filled half the band, you'll get the other sign of carriers. So you would expect a crossover to be at about 0.5, but if you vary the T and T prime parameters, that can shift around, and at least using values that seemed consistent for the cuprates, they end up getting a crossover at about 0.32 or so, 0.35. That matches roughly where Batlogg's group some years ago found a change in the sign of the Hall coefficient. So that seemed to agree quite well. What we're probing is this regime where we're plotting 1 over RH. So 1 over RH would look something like this, and that's probably what this behavior is. And doing a quantitative comparison isn't really worth doing, frankly, because there's so many fit parameters and so few features on the data. But it's at least at about 0.18, we're recovering roughly one carrier per copper. At about 0.2, he's around one carrier per copper. So it agrees as well as I think it's responsible to push the fit. Now, ordinarily, you would expect that there'd be no temperature dependence to this. And so as you cooled down and took the same data, you'd just expect to get the same curve. It's just obscured by the superconductivity at low temperatures. And of course, what happens to us when we do the experiment is you see this peak that develops at temperatures below TC and is centered right on optimum doping. So the same data projected down on this plane show a ridge, if you will, that sits out to about 20 Kelvin and sits right at 0.15 in this system, at least.
That's the point of the insulated metal condition or the...
Nothing happens at the same place. So this is... Just as the, and unfortunately we can't do all the experiments in all the systems yet. So in the off chance that I don't have this in better stated in another slide, here. So this is actually a good summary. This is what the log T in LSCO, which goes out to 0.16, and then it's the insulator metal crossover. And then the linear resistivity, which is still unpublished and we're still working on, but it looks like it's going to be at somewhere around 0.22. We can't do Hall effect in this yet, because unfortunately, God gave us these samples in big blocky chunks, whereas he gave us these in sort of 15 micron thick layers, which ends up amplifying the Hall voltage. So we're trying to mechanically thin these down, and so far we're not having enough luck to get high quality data. So we don't have Hall effect here. We've been looking like crazy to get a linear resistivity down to zero temperature, and we haven't found it yet. And it's believable that that also is going to be sample dependent, and it's going to be more that the observation is indicative of something, but the non-observation could be disorder, could be you don't have the carrier concentration tuned. But in this system, we can do both in-plane transport and Hall. The in-plane transport shows a log T that ends here, and then a Hall coefficient peak that sits right actually at 0.15. That's a typo. So in each case, we've got these two phenomena with the log T off to the left.
The dashed line is meant to indicate TC without the field?
Yes, TC schematically. So it is the case that TC goes to zero at 0.1 in BISCO, which is surprising. And that TC has a maximum of about 32, 35 at 0.16. But it's certainly not data. So we see this peak here at low temperatures, and now plotting that same peak in several different ways. Here, if we just plot the low temperature data, normalized to give you the number of carriers per copper as a function of doping, the Luttinger volume would be 1 plus P, because you have a half-filled band at zero doping, and so you would expect to get something like 1 plus P. But of course, even the TJ model gives you a nonlinear dependence on P. If for some reason you could argue that the mod insulating physics is still playing a role, this is what P would look like. So I just plot that as well. And clearly the data lie on the same graph. P doesn't work, that's right.
You had the same insidia calculations, you had better comparison there.
Which would?
The same
would be a better comparison. That's
what
right.
Would that look like?
So that would go to zero at zero, and then it would be concave up. And in fact, the data that I showed a few view graphs ago is is this same data. So the high temperature going down to something like 0.1 or so is at 0.1. So if that's 0.1 and here at 0.16 doping, if that were all the way up at 1, so our data are steeper than the calculation would indicate. So we have the other thing is that there's either a peak or a jump near optimum doping. And then finally, it's rather interesting that the onset of carriers is at the same point as the onset of superconducting, the superconducting phase. So it's as if whatever disorder or antiferromagnetism is localizing carriers, as soon as the carriers become mobile, then you're allowed to have superconductivity. And we've not, this is consistent with what we see in LSCO, where to this side, you have strong localization, you have exponential increases in the resistivity, and to this side, it's the log T behavior. So there does seem to be a strong localization transport that's killing the superconductivity on the underdoped side in these two compounds. One other phenomenon, the final phenomenon I'd like to point out before wrapping up the talk, is the correlation between Hall number and the superconducting transition temperature. So if we plot that same data in red that you saw in the previous graph, and now we plot the TC as measured in these samples, you can see that they tend to overlie as long as you allow yourself at least a multiplicative factor between the two. If you plot them on the same graph, TC here versus N Hall there, you get a linear plot for the underdoped samples. So those are the 7 data points shown in red, and then the overdoped samples end up not lying on that curve. And so this is reminiscent of the Uemura plot from some years ago, where from USR measurements, they were measuring at least a value that's proportional to the relaxation rate, and then they would estimate the absolute value of the relaxation rate, or sorry, the absolute value of the the condensed charge, the superfluid density, versus transition temperature. They found this linear plot among many samples. The data that tend to deviate tend to be overdoped data, and so it's only in the underdoped regime that you have this single universal behavior. And Uemura has made some measurements on these samples and ends up finding these 3 points for the 3 samples he's measured. So it does seem that single layer BISCO can be added to this large library, and there's other compounds as well, that show this universal behavior in the underdoped side. And at least our result would suggest that the superfluid density in the superconducting state corresponds roughly to the Hall density throughout the underdoped regime. It's difficult to do an exact comparison, but the suggestion is that if you've got no normal state carriers that can condense, then you have no superconductivity. And TC goes linearly with the number of particles in the normal state. Those quasi-particles in the normal state presumably are condensing to form the superfluid. And then, per this interpretation, you're in a Bose-Einstein regime where the TC is linearly dependent on the superfluid density. And the superfluidity, or superconductivity, is governed by the phase stiffness, the superfluid density in the underdoped regime. So to summarize the results, we've been able to measure Hall effect at low temperatures in single layer BISCO, which is fortuitously a thin wafer sample, and we're working to expand that to LSCO. This suggests that we can measure a Hall number in low temperatures because the data tend to be temperature independent as you get down to low temperatures. And you can essentially see as we evolve the technique. This is the first sample we made, the second sample we measured, and on down. So if you interpret that as a measurement of the Hall number, then there's a linear relationship between the superconducting transition temperature and the low temperature Hall number, which suggests that the phase stiffness is governing this superconducting transition in the underdoped regime. And then finally, there's a sharp anomaly in the doping dependence of the Hall number at optimum doping, which suggests some change in the Fermi surface. We'd like very much to do quantum oscillation experiments, but all of our attempts so far have failed. And these this picture, at least to us, suggests that there is some sort of quantum phase transition where the linear T resistivity behavior is perhaps quantum critical behavior, and that that is what's governing the stability of the high temperature superconducting phase. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Recent work on YBCO, where they can, as you know, make different samples
that are rather underdoped. Right.
Found a difference in this behavior with argued for phase fluctuation. I wonder if you've seen that. They're arguing that
local concentration
is not following this.
So this is their ordered YBCO?
Yeah.
I don't have anything specific to say to that result. We've attempted to get those samples into these fields, and the problem is both the samples and the fields are sufficiently finicky that we've not been successful, but it might well be worth another try because it's been several years. That's at one particular doping, right? And it happens to be where? Is that 0.125?
I think it's lower.
Okay. It's and so I don't know
it. I had a sequence of it for some reason. I realize you gotta be careful with the ortho, what ortho one it is, but I have to get out the paper.
I certainly
interesting to see how it compares
what
you're saying here, because it's such a key picture.
Yes.
So whether we're to believe it's phase fluctuations that are destroying it down here, which seem very natural.
Right.
Or if it's not
then what is governing it? Well, the other thing that always occurs to me to worry about is we know, sorry?
It's a different measure.
They're measuring rho s, I guess, correlating rho s with TC rather than not all
numbers.
Yeah. Right.
So
right. So, right. So everybody's doing this sort of measurement. And the only thing that occurs to me to worry about is that we know that at 1/8 there's other things that are happening. And it's possible that at these particular staging concentrations that there's yet other things happening. But, you know, all it takes is one solid counterexample to throw a lot of interpretation out the window. We just felt it was quite surprising that we were seeing this linear behavior that seems to go through the origin at the onset of superconductivity. And again, this is one of the things we'd like to test in LSCO and haven't been able to yet. Any other questions?
Optical conductivity, where does that stand?
Ah, yes. So the optical conductivity, we've got a technique that Scott Crooker has developed, a product of UCSB. And what he needs now is for this magnet to come back online. because this magnet, the pulses I was showing were only tens of milliseconds long. And you can hold those magnets in your hand and they're just sort of one stick of dynamite worth of energy. This thing is about 200 sticks of dynamite and it's a meter across and 2 meters tall. And the reason that you work so hard to get something that big is that then the pulse ends up being seconds long and it gives you a tenth of a second at 60 Tesla. There's a 250 megajoule feedback circuit that stabilizes the magnetic field at 60 Tesla for a tenth of a second. And so Scott's got a technique to do terahertz spectroscopy where you launch a very short pulse in the time domain and then you do the Fourier transform in the transmitted signal. And that allows you to then get signal of omega, both real and imaginary parts, without doing Cramer's Kronig. And he's been able to put that at the end of 10 meters of fiber by reverse chirping so that the whole pulse ends up getting thinner and faster, not faster, but skinnier. As it approaches the sample and then ends up being a very short pulse right at the sample. But he can do 10 million of those pulses during one magnet pulse to get the signal to noise where he needs it to be. And so we're hoping that that will be one of the first experiments that we do on the 60T long pulse, as we call it. We used to call this quasi-continuous, but then the guys who make the DC magnets claimed that if this was quasi-continuous, then theirs were quasi-eternal. So. So that's a terahertz spectroscopy. There's also the possibility of doing resonance in gigahertz frequency ranges. So you make a cavity that fortunately, it's a nice accident that as you go up towards 100 gigahertz and beyond, your resonant cavities get small enough that they fit inside this, the bore of this magnet. We've made one that's all non-metallic by using multi-layers to make a multi-layer mirror for the gigahertz. So the thing does not heat up with eddy currents. The other nice thing is that... multi-layer dielectric, yes. And the other thing is that this is a work of Ross McDonald, who came from Oxford with John Singleton. The other thing that's nice is if you have a Q of 10,000, ordinarily at RF-type frequencies, it would never ring up during the time the magnetic field is on. But when you're up at a few hundred gigahertz, it rings up in a microsecond. And so the DC field is being slowly swept while the resonant cavity is just happy as can be. And so we've done measurements with that that suggest that those two will be quite fruitful in, when we get this magnet rebuilt, which should be end of 2004. But I quit that job to get promoted, so it's no longer my responsibility. Wait, is this mic still on? Oh, shit. And if the NSF was listening in, I take back what I said. So there really is a general message here as well, which is that for better or for worse, we're developing these techniques as we go along, and so it's several years before I can plot another value on the y-axis. But the sky is the limit, essentially, as far as getting signal to noise on many, many techniques. We've now done thermal conductivity in sub-millisecond timescales using a 3 omega technique that I can describe. But we've looked at CMR materials, we find the phase transition, and so we'd like to take those to the coup rates as well in order to look at thermal conductivity at least through this regime. And then if you can measure, there's another way you can measure thermal diffusivity, and if you take the ratio, then you've got specific heat. So we actually think that we might be able to do specific heat someday on these things down to 1 Kelvin or 0.3 Kelvin. I may have lost all my hair by then, but we're hopeful. It's not a problem? Okay, all right. It's good to hear. That was Audie Stern, Audie Stern.
Data on underdog YVCO?
No, well, we have some. It's the magnetoresistance is so large with YVCO that I don't think I have any of the data here, that we can't do our usual interpretation of, well, we've killed the superconductivity, now we're in the normal state, at least as far as transport's concerned. And so we really haven't included it in the discussion because we end up not knowing how to plot the low temperature limit of rho versus T. So the short answer is we don't know how to fit it into this story, but we probably should write it up and at least present it.
All right. You showed a few of the linear plots, and it's probably, there's a lot of old data, rho versus T.
Yes.
The ones that you showed certainly didn't, you could resolve the intercept on the projected to the T0.
Yes. Are you talking in particular about the LSC data?
Yeah, I think it was LSC.
Where we find the linear, at least what looks to us to be linear T down to low temperatures? Okay. Right, so it's about... The slope tends to be universal. The intercept tends to depend on what is thought to be disorder in the sample. This, in fact, hasn't even been normalized to resistivity. This is just in ohms. As far as, I'm just trying to think what plot would be meaningful. The standard question among experimentalists, or at least when I argue with myself, which is not a sign of mental disorder, it's when you start losing the arguments. So in the overdope regime, you seem to have this upward concave behavior when you're just asking about the linear T.
Yeah.
So we haven't really done a careful study because in almost all the samples we look at, it tends to deviate to this temperature-independent behavior. And so anything that someone's doing in zero magnetic field would be more accurate than anything we're doing. And if there were linear behavior down to zero temperature, at least we would expect it to be somewhere in this regime between the optimum doping and where we clearly are in a concave up behavior. So we'd be looking in that regime. Yeah, the zinc doping, Uchida's group did a lot with zinc doping, and we did some early measurements on the zinc doping. As you may know, you can kill superconductivity with zinc. It also changes all of the resistivity behaviors above TC. And so it basically makes everything more resistive and makes the divergence larger and faster. This was zinc-doped YBCO, I think we were looking at. And so we didn't get to the point of seeing systematics that at least I found compelling. And so there's no strict behavior. The log T we didn't find. We seem to see exponential resistivity as if there were strong localization going on. I mean, I would actually expect that if you could take this sample and make it cleaner, it would probably get a smaller and smaller insulating behavior, and maybe the insulating behavior would go away eventually. At least my thought is that if, in fact, there is some quantum phase transition here, the underdoped side is more prone to localization behavior. Either for simple reasons it has fewer carriers, or it's not that many fewer carriers, it may actually be that there's something in the physics of the ground state that makes localizing easier, weak localizing, easier to do. So if this were Bert, I'd know you were all thinking.
I mean, I guess if there are no more questions, we should just thank Ray again.
Thank you. And thanks for all coming during a week when there's a conference as well. I appreciate it.